kind of refresh our memory a little bit since we didn't have services last Sunday. If you're like me, you can forget things pretty easily. In Revelation 1, we were introduced to the main character in the book, and that's Jesus Christ, who was walking among the churches. Then those seven churches are addressed personally in Revelation 2 and 3. Then in Revelation chapters 4 and 5, we see God the Father being worshipped in Revelation 4. In Revelation 5, God the Son being worshipped. And we recall the scene. We have the the various ones around the throne worshiping God. There is a scroll with seven seals. At first, John was disappointed because no one was going to be able to open it. No one was worthy to open it. No one had the qualifications to open it. But someone was found, and that, of course, was the Lamb, Jesus Christ. And so we see him beginning to open those seven seals. And so in chapter 6, we see him opening those seals, six of them. Four of them were represented by riders on different horses. And then we saw the souls of those under the throne, and we had all of those six seals basically were about God's answer to the Christians in the first century who were being persecuted. And his answer was that those people who are persecuting you, their time is coming. Their time is coming. And basically from Revelation chapter 6 all the way through Revelation chapter 20, all 15 of those chapters is God's response. And sometimes he does it over and over again in different ways, represents the same thing, that God is in control. He knows what's happening to his people on earth. He knows how they're being persecuted by the Roman Empire, how many of them have been killed and in other ways tormented and tortured and persecuted. And so God answers them in a number of different ways, different symbols, that he will, when he's ready, and in the way he's going to, take vengeance on those people who are persecuting his people. And so the majority of the book of Revelation is that, is God's response to those people. And so we see those six seals in chapter 6. All of those basically the same thing. How God is in various ways going to judge those people who are persecuting those Christians. And so it's his response through inspiration, through John, to tell those people that he hears their prayers, they've come up before him, and he's going to respond. He's going to respond. Revelation chapter 7 is kind of an interlude where we see the four angels being held back by God at the four corners of the earth, ready and waiting to take vengeance on those persecutors. And so that's the first six seals. There's one seal left now, and that is Revelation chapter 8. We see the seal opened, and when that seal is opened, now we have seven angels with seven trumpets who are going to call people to arms, in a sense, saying God is ready, like trumpets did, especially during Old Testament times. Someone would blow a trumpet. Usually it was a call to arms. A battle was ready. Something was ready to happen. It was an alarm. It was a warning. It was a sound saying that the time is now. And so we see those seven angels with seven trumpets when the seventh seal is opened. And so that brings us to Revelation chapter 8. Notice verse 1. When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Literally 30 minutes? No. Most things in Revelation aren't literal. It's a symbol. There's a short time going to take place. And why silence? And a lot of examples have been given of why silence. You know, often when you're in a courtroom, this is one example. Before the verdict is given, what do? There's some silence before it. Before that verdict is announced, guilty, not guilty, whatever, there's silence. And so we have that in heaven. There's silence. There is a period of waiting. Something is getting ready to be announced that's vitally important. And the people need to be ready to hear it. So verse 2, "And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets, announcing something's going to happen. Then another angel, not one of those seven, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hand." As is often in the book of Revelation, there's allusions to the law of Moses and the various items that were both in the tabernacle and then later in the temple. The censer, from which is kind of a pan, I guess kind of be a modern day equivalent, kind of a pan that had the embers in it from which fire was taken. And you see that's what's happening here. And of course there was more than one altar there in the temple and the tabernacle. So there's allusions back to those things. Not a literal altar. There aren't any physical altars like that. In heaven especially. Not a real, physical, literal golden censer. But something is going to happen. God is paying attention, and maybe this is the most important point in those two verses. God is paying attention to the prayers of His saints. And you know, it's just a given when difficult times come, especially to God's people, what do they tend to do more often? Pray. So these are very, very difficult times. So it's just a given that there will be many, many prayers offered up by the saints. You know, God help us. God do something for us. Take care of our persecutors. You know, David, many of the Psalms in the Old Testament, those imprecatory Psalms, are, you know, David saying, God, take care of my enemies. Destroy my enemies. Take care of them. Condemn them. Judge them. And so that's what's happening here. The prayers of the saints are going up to the Father, and He hears them. And I think that's the most important point in those two verses. God hears those prayers. He knows what's going on. Nothing is escaping His attention. And He's going to respond to them. But He's going to respond to them in His way, which is the best way, and in His own time, which is the best time. And that's the message the people needed to hear. Remember, this was written for people in the first century. So they're ascending before God. Well, what happens? The angel takes the censer, verse 5, fills it with fire from the altar and threw it to the earth. And there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. So the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. As I mentioned a while ago, something was getting ready to happen on the earth, or to the earth. Noises, thunderings, lightnings, and earthquake, all... This is not the first time this has happened in Revelation. Of course, it happened many times in the Old Testament too. God is getting ready to show His power, His authority. And He's going to show it in a very visible, outward way. He's the one that controls all these things, and He's the one that's in charge, and He's going to respond to the prayers that's coming up to Him from the saints, that they're being persecuted. He's going to take care of it in just the right way. And so He's showing now, through this symbolism, that He is all-powerful. Just like He did on Mount Sinai when the law of Moses was given, and at other times, He's showing His power. And He is the one that has all the power. So, the seven angels are preparing with their trumpets to sound. Here's the first one, verse 7. "The first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up." There's the first one. Are we picturing a literal angel in heaven with a literal trumpet, with literal hail and literal fire mingled with literal blood? And was there just a third of the trees burned up? and all the green grass was burned up. Well, we see you just can't go through Revelation and pick out, okay, I want to make these things literal and I want to make those things symbolic or those things figurative. You have to look at what the overall picture is in the book of Revelation, and that is God is in control, and for those people who are faithful, those people in the first century, but as well for us, those people who are faithful will be victorious. God will see to it that you're victorious. Yeah, it may cost you your life, but that's still victory. And that's the message. And so that message is depicted in dozens of different ways in the book. We've seen it depicted already in this book, and we're going to see it many more times before we finish with Revelation 22, that God will ensure the victory. And God is going to take vengeance on your persecutors. He is going to do that. One way here, it's pictured. Again, God is in control of the world, isn't He? This chapter only talks about four of those trumpets. And then the next chapter starts with the others. And there's a difference in these seven trumpets. These first four trumpets all refer to things in the natural world, the physical world. And so He uses that to help people see what He's going to do and how He's going to do it, so they'll understand what's going to happen. And so He uses all these scenes that people are familiar with to show that God is powerful and He's going to take vengeance on them. And take vengeance on those people in the Roman Empire who were persecuting, killing Christians. God's in control and He's going to do it. He's going to take care of them. So here it's depicted. Hail and fire mixed with blood. It's going to be thrown to the earth. A third of the trees were burned up and all green grass was burned up. Literally a third? No. He's trying to say that not all was going to be destroyed. Some? Yes, not all. And of course, we'll see as we go on that that's exactly what He meant. Notice the second angel, very similar. Then the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood. Well, the first one had to do with the earth and green grass, trees, and so forth. This one has to do with the sea. So there was like a great mountain burning, thrown into the sea. Usually, especially in the Old Testament, a great mountain depicted a kingdom, a country, a power, a nation. It was on fire, it was burning up, it was being thrown into the sea. And as a result, of course, part of what was in the sea was destroyed. And of course, the Roman Empire had a great navy in the first century. This might be an allusion to the fact that God was going to destroy, in some ways, part of that great navy. And if you go back and we read Edward Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, you read about a lot of the things that happened to the Roman Empire that eventually brought it down. It was the world empire for nearly 400 years, controlled pretty much the whole world during that time. But it fell, it declined for a number of reasons. The one that has to do with what we're talking about tonight had to do with a lot of natural disasters that happened to the Roman Empire that helped, wasn't the sole reason it was brought down, that helped bring it down. Of course, some of those are very well known, like, you know, AD 79, the eruption of Mount Vesuvius and how it destroyed Pompeii and some of the other cities in that area. Not too much after that erupted and the whole mountain was burning, and it was near the sea. And if you read much about volcanoes, you know that some of the gases that come out of a volcano when it's erupting is sulfur and very poisonous, very toxic, and that often is the most dangerous thing about the eruption of a volcano, or those toxic gases. That happened also in the Roman Empire. A lot of those things, natural disasters, happened. in the first century and then, of course, later. And Gibbon says that that was one of the reasons that helped bring down the Roman Empire. This could very well be an allusion, at least many people think so, to what was going to happen. Obviously, some catastrophes in the natural world that was going to be brought against the Roman Empire and was going to hurt the Roman Empire. Their resources, natural resources, monetary resources, in so many different ways. What does the third angel do? Verse 9 or 10. Then the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on the third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter. And again, this goes very much back to the Old Testament. And some of these soundings of the trumpets are similar to the plagues that God brought upon Egypt, which was an evil nation that was persecuting His people back at that time. And He brought plagues upon those people, those Egyptians, that nation. One of those, of course, had to do with water. Well, now He's talking about a burning torch falling from heaven. And had a name, wormwood, and which basically has the idea of something that's very, very bitter. And if you've ever tasted something that's bitter, it is nauseating. Just nauseating. Remember the first time I ever took a little sip of oil of oregano. I don't know if anybody in here has ever tried that. Guarantee you it's the nastiest thing God ever created on earth. I was warned before I took it. The lady where I bought it said, "Have you ever tasted this before?" I said, "No." She says, "Well, you get prepared because I guarantee you you've never tasted anything like it." Which I thought she was fooling me. She was right on. That stuff is so nasty, it is beyond belief. So bitter. And I think about that when I read this. Wormwood. Bitter. It's just something you can't stand. And that's how God's depicting what He's going to do to the Roman Empire. And of course, in principle, it would apply to people that have persecuted His people since then. But certainly to those in the first century, this had a very specific application. God was going to make their life bitter in a number of different ways. And they would regret the fact that they were persecuting His people. His judgment, in other words, would be bitter. What does the fourth angel do? Fourth angel sounded, verse 12, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of them were darkened. A third of the day did not shine, and likewise the night. Now here's the fourth angel. Sun, moon, and stars. Did a third of the sun just go out and stop working? Well, no. But there's the symbol, again, that God is in charge of everything and that His judgment that He's going to bring on those persecutors will be severe, won't be total, won't be total, won't be complete. Again, why He uses the idea of a third throughout. But light is fading. See, a third of the sun provides light. Moon reflects light. Stars produce light. So when He's saying there's a third of them, you know, light is always depicted in the Bible as something that's good. You know, good is depicted as being light, and all love is depicted as being light. So it's in a way saying God is taking away part of what's good to the Roman Empire. Because they persecuted His people. So He's darkening those things. Not literally, He's not slicing the moon into three pieces and taking part of it away. But the moon reflected light. The stars produced light. The sun produced light. And so symbolically produced good and things that were right. And they were going to be taken away. Again, God's judgment. It's all about God's judgment. And this judgment, hopefully, was going to bring about reformation. But it probably wouldn't. But hopefully it would. And so he ends up this chapter. And I looked, and I heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, because of the remaining blast of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." Some other manuscripts have eagle there, and it's the same idea. We have, you know, a symbol, again, of God's messenger delivering this message. Woe, woe, woe. Reminds us of that scene around the throne back in Isaiah chapter 6, beginning in verse 1, you know, going down to about verse 8, where we see angels around the throne of God. And there is that same idea of woe. You know, that, and repeated three times, just is done for intensity. Great woe for all of those individuals who are persecuting God's people. And think about how you would feel when you were first reading this letter. You were living in Thyatira or Philadelphia, and you were being persecuted, and you had to be careful every day where you went, and you knew friends of yours or relatives that had been imprisoned or killed because they wouldn't bow down to the idols of the Roman emperors. And you get this letter from John, the aged apostle. And this letter, through inspiration, is telling you symbolically, figuratively, but the people in the first century, especially Christians, understood those symbols. It's almost like a code. People in the Roman Empire, they probably wouldn't have understood any of it. Christians understood it. They understood those symbols. So they knew when they got this letter that God is telling them, I'm hearing your prayers. I know exactly what is happening to you. And I am going to rectify it. I'm going to take care of the situation. I'm in charge, and I have the power to take vengeance on the Roman Empire, and I am going to do it, but I'm going to do it in a variety of ways. Seven trumpets. A variety of ways. The first four tended to talk about natural calamities and catastrophes and judgments that God's going to bring on the Roman Empire. And so we see this messenger flying around saying, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth. Not every inhabitant of the earth, but those people who were persecuting God's people, the Christians. Because there's three more trumpets yet to sound, and they were going to be awful. So it's a warning that God is going to bring and take vengeance on those people who were persecuting Christians in the first century. So it would be so encouraging to read this letter to know that God is in charge and that He's going to take vengeance. And much of what happens from Revelation chapter 7, again, all the way through Revelation chapter 1, is saying to those people that I am not going to let the Roman Empire, those priests who were associated with that, who were trying to go around and enforce emperor worship and so forth, I'm not going to let those people get away with it. That's much of what the entire book of Revelation is about. I'm not going to let them get away with it. They will pay. I will take vengeance on them, and I'll do it in a lot of different ways. But when you see it happening, know why it's happening, because I'm causing it. And he wanted the Christians to know in the first century, and then all the way until the Roman Empire fell in 300-some A.D., whatever, that he was the one behind it, that he was the one causing the fall. They needed to know that. And of course, the lesson for us today is that he's still in charge. He's never not been in charge. And when we offer up our prayers to him, that's how they go up to him, as if it's a sweet-smelling aroma that goes to him. And he enjoys smelling those prayers. He enjoys hearing those prayers. And everything we pray and everything going on in our lives, He knows everything about it. And He responds to those prayers just like He did to the people in the first century. He responds to them in the best way. Because we don't know the best way to respond, but He does. And so He responds to those prayers in the very best way. He may respond to them with no. He may respond to them in an entirely different way. He may respond to them in a variety of ways like He did in the first century. But the timing will be perfect. The response will be perfect just like it was in the first century. That's the encouragement that they had. That's the encouragement we have today. Basically, it comes down to trusting God's promises. That when He says, be faithful even to the point of death, whether you give up your life for the cause or whatever, the most important thing is remaining faithful. That means, first of all, becoming a Christian, as we talked about this morning, by being immersed, having your sins washed away, but then being faithful. Having a commitment to the cause, like those people in the first century did. They're great examples to us. Those people who were martyred are great examples to us about being faithful, and that's what He calls us to do. So if you need to respond tonight, I encourage you to come as we stand and sing this next song.